Ryan Reynolds here from Mint Mobile. With the price of just about everything going up during inflation, we thought we'd bring our prices down. So to help us, we brought in a reverse auctioneer, which is apparently a thing.
Mint Mobile Unlimited Premium Wireless. I bet you get 30, 30, I bet you get 30, I bet you get 20, 20, 20, I bet you get 20, 20, I bet you get 15, 15, 15, 15, just $15 a month, sold.
Give it a try at mintmobile.com/switch.
$45 up front for 3 months plus taxes and fees. Promo rate for new customers for limited time. Unlimited more than 40 gigabytes per month. Slows full terms at mintmobile.com.
I'm Manveen Rana from The Story, a daily news podcast from The Times. Join me and my co-host, Luke Jones, for a deep dive into the big stories and investigations. Plus, each month, William Hague hosts an agenda-setting interview with a key newsmaker or big thinker. That's The Story, The Times' daily podcast that brings you one remarkable story told in depth. Listen every weekday on the Times Radio app or wherever you get your podcasts.
Hello and welcome to the Game Podcast from The Times. I'm Gabriel Marcotti, and I thank you for joining us. Now, in the studio with me, it's Bill Edgar making his return, one of your favorites. And it's former Arsenal midfielder Stuart Robson. Wonder if we'll be talking some Wenger later. That's right. The longest-serving manager in English football will be stepping down at the end of the season. Henry Winter will be joining us to discuss that. That's how big this item of news is. But we're going to begin at Wembley. Why are we beginning at Wembley, not with Wenger? Well, because our producer, Charlie, made the point that people might be all Wengered out, and all those United fans might be switching off this podcast and be like, oh, well, you know, with more Wenger. Don't worry, we're going to start with Mourinho versus Pochettino on Saturday.
Is that how the Manchester United fans speak?
Some of the ones I know, yes. Bill's a Manchester United fan, he speaks differently. Bill, speak.
Hello, Gab.
See, there you go. Okay, so it's another FA Cup final for Jose Mourinho. They overcome Tottenham. What was a turning point in this game? Because it looked to me like United just stepped it up in the second half and Spurs had no answer.
I thought the turning point was the equalising goal. Tottenham were running riot. Son, although he didn't play at his best, they kept on finding him out on that left-hand side. Eriksen was finding space. Harry Kane early on in the game and twisted and turned away from challenges. Manchester United looked leggy. They looked as though they didn't have an answer to what Tottenham were doing. The midfield players couldn't get Herrera, who ended up being one of the top players, was beaten too easily early on. But the change happened when Pogba won the ball in midfield off Dembele, produced a magnificent cross for Sanchez, and the game changed. Suddenly Tottenham went into their shell and Manchester United grew in confidence.
Yeah, Pogba, I mean, people say I'm obsessed with the guy, but I thought he played really well. He had that other, he had an incredible pass too for Lukaku, which Lukaku then put wide, Bill. Is this, like, when we were talking about big name players and stuff, I mean, Alexis Sanchez also very productive.
Yeah.
Is this why they're there?
Absolutely. Pogba and Sanchez are absolutely world-class players who must make a difference eventually. I mean, Sanchez has taken a few games to get used to the new system. I've mentioned before, I mean, when United are on the counter-attack, often Sanchez will go up there and he's either on his own or there's one teammate up there with him. So a bit different words with Arsenal, a lot more players in support. So you've got to get used to holding the ball up a bit more. The United a bit more cautious, but he's a sensational player and will no doubt be a great success. But Pogba, I've said this before, I thought he had a decent first season. I thought he's a bit underrated just because his price tag and because of his haircuts and all the rest of it. But he had a decent first season, I thought, and he started well this season. Then he got injured, and when he came back, he's been quite off form. But on Saturday, he was dominating. He brings something different to United that no other player can. He's just so strong. He just holds on to the ball, and he was excellent on Saturday, albeit in a three, which I think it has to be. People have said this a lot, but either struggles with concentration in terms of his defensive side, or he just doesn't think it's important enough to track people. When with Tottenham's goal, Pogba was the wrong side of Eriksen when Eriksen made his run down the right, so Eriksen had a free cross, so you can blame him for that, Pogba. But otherwise, I think he's a fantastic player.
Bill Edgar giveth and Bill Edgar taketh away. I love it when you go all biblical there, Bill. United's back four
is all, and De Gea, of course, all Ferguson era signings. Obviously, people say that's an indictment of the club and whatever else. I'm assuming Bailly would have played if available. But you think Mourinho is going to stick with these guys next year? Because he likes his sort of veteran loyals. Like,
every so often, Smalling and Jones come together again and they play well for four or five games, and everyone says maybe they were the centre-half partnership that we always thought they were going to be. When they were the under-21 pair, everyone said they
were Vidic and Ferdinand.
Yeah, they were going to be the players. They were bought almost together to be exceptional players, exceptional back two. And on occasions, they show that. And they defended well in the second half of the game the other day. They were caught on a couple of occasions early on. Smalling is being told by Southgate that he's not quite good enough on the ball, but I don't think Mourinho is too worried about that. Jones is okay on the ball, but not always good in the air. So they have their frailties. But I can't see any reason to get rid of them at the moment. The other players, Lindelof that's come in, hasn't been anywhere near as good as those two. And Bailly is a good athlete, but again, I don't think he reads danger particularly well, and he's not great on the ball. So those two are as good as any they've got at the moment.
I think they're becoming more consistent. They've had problems with inconsistency. Also, the big problem is injuries, exactly. Now, Smalling has improved a lot in that sense, and Jones is getting a bit better. But they're at their best. I mean, they're so fast, they're agile, they're strong. I mean, you could, you know, if you saw them for the first time, you think, well, this is England's partnership, you know, forever. Why is there debate about who else might play? But of course, they have been inconsistent. As you say, Jones does have a slight problem in the air. He's only 5'11", I think, which is tiny for a centre back.
Well, I think he got exposed a few years ago, didn't he, by Shola Amiobi, was it, when they went to Newcastle and Amiobi scored a two or three. And from that moment on, he was then played at right back. He was then played in midfield. So they never trusted him at centre-half. Alex Ferguson didn't trust him at centre-half. No. Now Mourinho's taking him back into that centre-half position.
I want to talk Pochettino because there's an area where Mourinho excels. And this is something that people in football, in every sport, they talk about. They talk about sort of the killer instinct, getting the team over the line, this sort of undefinable quality that when you're right there and, you know, you get to the final and you push through, right? And Mourinho, in fact, hasn't lost many finals. I tend to believe that there is such a thing because there are certain people who seem to keep excelling in those situations. But then I get a little bit analytical and I say, you know what? Better teams tend to win. United were the favorites in this game. There's no mystical, magical killer instinct. It's just a small sample size.
Going into the game?
Ahead of Spurs on the table, they have better players. I mean,
the fact that it was at Wembley was, you know, counting against them. Okay, they had the same number of supporters, but it was still Tottenham's home.
I would say, having seen their recent games, that Tottenham were the more informed team, that they had more quality. I'm just backing up your point that when that first goal went in, the equaliser went in, the stuffing seemed to be knocked out of Spurs. That belief they had early on where they were going to take the early goal.
And I don't like doing this, but I said a few years ago, you know, with the year that Spurs collapsed and Leicester won the title, that, you know, maybe there was an issue of personality, that maybe this team, other than Dele Alli and Alderweireld, maybe they were a little soft. Certainly, you know, Eriksen, Kane, even Dyer admittedly was fouling people, like, that notwithstanding, like, these were basically kind of like quite choir boys, but you didn't necessarily see that obvious leadership. But I honestly don't know. But then again, stuff like this happens, and I wonder, how do they go so limp all of a sudden?
Yeah, I'm not sure it's quite an implosion in that United did play well. And you think, well, they got knocked out of the Champions League by Juventus, but actually they played really well. They were unlucky to get knocked out by Juventus.
They could have been 3-0 down at halftime.
They could have been, but
leg.
Overall, the two ties, they deserved to win, I thought, comfortably. And I
agree with you there.
But
the whole point of the killer instinct argument, I said, I don't know that if I buy it, but a lot of people bring it up, is that that's exactly what you're lacking, right? You can outplay the opposition, but then you don't get it over the line, whereas Mourinho is kind of the reverse of that.
20 minutes into the game on Saturday, Tottenham are going to win the game by... You're looking at it, they're going to win the game four goals to nil. They're totally dominating the play. They're playing a tempo that Manchester United couldn't cope with. They were running beyond Manchester United's midfield. It was making it hard for the centre-backs, Smalling and Jones, to make decisions because there was movement all around them. And suddenly, as soon as the goal went in, Tottenham went back to playing at a slow tempo, playing across the back. It was almost that fear was set in. And that's, I think, what you're talking about.
Did you understand the Son substitution as well?
No, not really. I thought he was the one that was finding a bit of space. He didn't play at his very best. He didn't make the right decisions.
No, but the outlet, he provides width. Like,
he was going to pace past people. He was trying to make things happen.
One thing on Pochettino, and we in the media sometimes are guilty of reading too much about this, but you know, he comes out afterwards and he starts talking about Tottenham in the third person, and he said, with me or with another manager. Is this just us reading too much out of it, or did he know what he was doing when he said that?
It did sound a bit suspicious. Yeah, he's at worst, he's saying, I'm going to leave unless you give me a much bigger playing budget in the summer. And even at best, he's just getting his excuses in and saying, well, let's look at the relative budgets of the big six. So whenever Tottenham have a bad result like this, then it shouldn't reflect badly on him.
Now, this season, with your subscription to The Times and The Sunday Times, you can watch every highlight and every goal from every game in the Premier League, Champions League, Europa League, and the FA Cup. And on top of that, much better than this, you get all our excellent content. Now, just £8 for an 8-week trial. Bill, your favourite goal of the weekend in the Premier League or the FA Cup?
I'd like to Olivier Giroud for Chelsea in the FA Cup.
Ah, the dancing Frenchman.
Yeah, dancing Frenchman. Firstly, Hazard, who was just unbelievable, plucking the ball out of the sky and then knocking it on for Giroud in a tight space. But the fact that Giroud took a few touches, also dummied the ball to beat players by just, you know, dummying the ball, left four defenders and the keeper all on their backsides and scoring, so it looked great.
Big special worth checking out, Stuart?
I'm going for the goal that Pogba made for Sanchez. I thought it showed Pogba for being the world-class player that I think he is and can be, and potentially the best midfield player in the world. And I want to see him do more of that, because when he was at Juventus, I thought he could do anything.
Who knew Stuart Robson was such a Pogba fanboy? Now, in the other semi-final, Chelsea defeat Southampton 2-0. Let's start with the lineup, because he puts Fabregas in there, presumably thinking that Southampton were going to park the bus, which I thought they kind of did, right? So Tadic, Redmond, Ward-Prowse, all the guys who can play are on the bench, and you have Long and Austin up front. And he starts Giroud instead of Morata, which you might tell me, Stuart, he's been vindicated given the amount of chances that Morata missed in the second half.
Well, as you probably already know, anybody that plays centre-forward for Antonio Conte has to be good with his back to goal, because so much goes through the centre-forward. When it goes into Hazard, he's not... Where Hazard and Willian do so well is that they're flicking balls around the corner. The centre-forward has to be ready for it, to play the little 1-2s. If he's not ready, the manager's going to go mad and the other players will go mad at him. And I think Giroud has possibly done that better than Morata has done.
Morata should be doing it better, because he's more skillful.
Morata should be doing it much better, and that's why he was bought to do that job. That's why Batshuayi couldn't do it, because he wasn't good enough with his back to goal. And he was hoping that Giroud could do the job, and he did it to a certain degree. He lost possession four or five times when Shida was too tight to him or tight to him and nicked the ball off him. But that's why I think he was picked in the team. And I suppose he was vindicated, because Giroud scores the first goal, and then when he gets tired, he puts on Morata, and Morata and Azpilicueta did what they've done all season. Azpilicueta bending that ball in, Morata finding a bit of space in between the fullback and the centre-half. So I can understand why he played Giroud.
You could see them, if the season was just starting now, I wouldn't be surprised if Giroud and Morata played 19 league games each, and each went off after an hour, replaced by the other one. They seem...
Morata's a better player, in my view, having seen him at Juventus, having seen him at Real Madrid, but he just hasn't played well enough for Chelsea so far this season.
He obviously has a higher ceiling, I think. Now Mark Hughes, Sparky, unhappy with the lack of VAR when there was an incident when Austin seemed to collide with Caballero, and Caballero kind of went behind the goal line. It was ruled a foul, it was not a goal. He wanted VAR to review that. which incidentally I'm not familiar with them with the protocol, because I don't think you can review that, right? Because
he couldn't review it because the referee blew a whistle for a foul before the ball went into the net, so he's not reviewing a goal.
Yeah, exactly.
So he'd already blown for a foul. If he'd have let the goal happen, then it would have been reviewed, and he could say, no, it's a foul, or, yeah, I'm going to give a goal.
As with a possible offside, you let the play go on for a couple of seconds, see if the ball goes in.
But then, once he blew his whistle for a foul, he couldn't change his mind.
No.
Beyond that, to me, and maybe it's sort of my soft, continental background, but how is that not a foul, running into the goalkeeper like that?
That's your soft continental mentality.
But I'm
sorry, I thought that was the days of Nat Lofthouse were over. I know.
What do you think he did badly then? The ball's above him, he's backing in to try and win the ball in the air, and the goalkeeper makes a complete mess of it.
Well, I mean, yeah, it's not quite Nat Lofthouse shoulder charge, obviously, but I think... actually, keepers in that situation generally do get a free kick. If they get a little nudge, it was a little nudge, and they, as a result, they're off balance and they can't catch it.
Goalkeepers can go with their knees up, right into the back of centre forwards, and that's okay.
Yeah. But that's how the game is officiated today. You can't just time travel back to the days of Nat Lofthouse because Sparky thinks that it's the right thing to do.
There was hardly any contact between the two.
There was enough contact for Caballero to fall backwards into his own goal, right?
No, he only fell backwards because he dropped the ball and then tried to catch it going backwards.
I thought he was knocked back a little, and you only have to be knocked back 6 inches and you can't catch it too easily. I mean, it's such a tricky one, such a grey area. How much contact should you be allowed?
In the end, it doesn't matter, because once he'd given the free kick, he could never have reviewed it.
No.
It wasn't a disallowed goal. It was a free kick.
Yeah, I think, more.
Sparky was making an excuse, because I've got to say, I thought his side set up so negatively and didn't offer anything to the game whatsoever.
Until the last 5 minutes.
Yeah.
It's unbelievable. The last 5 minutes, they were like the champions. They were irresistible. What happened?
Southampton have obviously been in cup finals before. Is this a case where, to be fair to Hughes, he says, look, I'm here for one job, right? I'm here to keep us up. That's why I'm going to save my skill players and play these other guys. And I'll just park the bus and see what happens. And we'll try to hang in there. But ultimately, I will be judged on whether I get us out of the relegation zone.
He won't get them out of the relegation zone. I think they're doomed.
Okay, well, thank you, Nostradamus. But what I'm saying is, that was his plan, right? Whereas if he plays...
I'm not sure it was his plan. I think he thought that if he played with two up front and they kept on sticking the ball in behind Chelsea's back three, he could cause some problems. And it happened on a couple of occasions early on in the game.
Why would you play those guys and not play the good players?
Because they're not going to run in behind. They were going to play long ball football. They were going to stick... Long has caused Chelsea problems before when Chelsea tried to play a high... But Chelsea's defenders read it quite easily yesterday. Rudiger, I thought, was excellent. He just backs off at the right time. Cahill still has problems. And Azpilicueta is one of the best defenders in the Premier League.
It was only a change of tactics. It wasn't really just leaving out all his best players. No. I mean, everybody else was playing. He would have played otherwise in the league. So I think he was going for it. Obviously, the league is the priority because that's what his reputation... If they, say, got to the final but lost and they went down on his CV...
The only player that he left out that I think he would have played if it had been a Premier League game was Tadic, because Redmond hasn't played well enough this year. Ward-Prowse has fallen out of favour, although he's a decent player. Tadic is the only one he left out that would probably normally play.
I don't know, when I saw that with a back three with Bednarek and Højbjerg, and I was like, why don't you just go to them? I know it's not as your football, but just take it at them. Play the guys who are good. The guys who can play and pass. Don't make poor Mario Lemina, who on his day is really, really good.
Very good player.
Don't force him to go and chase Hazard and the little guys around all the time. Give him a platform to do something.
Having seen Southampton last year when they went to the League Cup final and outplayed Manchester United, only for Manchester United to win the game, to see them yesterday... What has gone wrong at Southampton? I mean, a couple of managers, but nothing's changed in terms of what's gone on this season.
You look at Southampton and West Brom, both in the top half last season. West Brom are going down, Southampton almost certainly. There's not that much change in terms of personnel.
Off Air, the podcast. with Jane Garvey and Fee Glover.
I go to the sink and I have some cheese.
You eat cheese in the sink?
Doesn't everybody?
Every Monday to Thursday, Jane and Fee keep the microphones on after their Times radio show.
I think if we were to do a Mr. and Mrs.
Oh, no.
Yes. How would that go in the booth?
Badly. Go very badly.
Unencumbered and off air.
Two tiny women with gobs.
Off air, the podcast. Now available on the Times radio app.
Love the game? Then don't miss The Game Daily. It's your lunchtime update from football's finest writers, and it's only at thetimes.co.uk. So unless you've been living under a rock of some kind, you might have heard the momentous news from Friday, Arsene Wenger announcing that he would resign as manager of Arsenal at the end of the season. We hope to be able to be joined by Henry Winter, who's got some great Wenger stories, in a few minutes. And we'll look at sort of how this transpired. We'll look at the issue of whether he was pushed or whether he jumped, as they say in the lingo. I would like you to both say, and Stuart, this might be tricky, I'd like you to both say three nice things that Arsene Wenger did for English football and for Arsenal.
I would say that his team, when Lundberg and Perez were playing in the wide areas, they were the side that started to break down off sidelines by making out runs from outside to in, which changed the way defenders had to defend. They couldn't just squeeze up and hold a high line. They had to worry about runs from outside to in. Defenders had to make bigger and better decisions. So I think his team, whether it was him or whether it was the two players themselves, they started to find ways that made the offside line not so hard to break down. There's one. His patience. I thought he's a very patient manager. When other managers, I think, would have got rid of players when players hadn't played particularly well, he showed great patience. He didn't always react as most managers, an English manager, would react. If you don't like what a player's done after a couple of games, you shout and scream at them and get them out of the team. He didn't do that. He showed a lot of patience for players and he allowed them to come back again. You know, there's lots of players that may have never played for Arsenal under another manager, Boué, when he had a couple of bad games. But Arsene
Wenger himself had a very tough first 6 months.
So he showed patience to those sort of players, and he knew that with a bit of love and an arm around their shoulder, they'd come back and be players again. So that's something that not all managers would do. So there's a second. And through his knowledge of nutrition and sports science at that time, I think he prolonged the careers of some of Arsenal's ageing players, like the Tony Adams, the Lee Dixons and those sort of players, the Nigel Winterburns, probably the David Stevens. So there's three things I'll give you.
Bill?
Three. Well, there's one main one is that he... certainly the second half of his reign, he almost did a service to English football by putting out an entertaining team that was never going to win the league, but it was always putting on a show, you know, a West End show for everybody. They invented the kind of the 1-2 in the opposition's goal area and the 6-yard box almost, the extra pass, which really didn't seem to be the best thing to do from an Arsenal point of view, but it's fantastic to watch because occasionally it would come off and there'd be this unbelievable series of intricate passes which led to goals, which was an amazing spectacle, and he just went on and on and on. Stuart touched on the preparation. I mean, whether the diet and the training methods would have changed anyway eventually, I don't know. Certainly he pushed them through early on.
That's probably the one aspect that's been easiest for other clubs to copy.
Yeah, because you just go to their training ground and see how it's done, yeah. And on a personal level, I think he's great for English football in terms of when he was asked a question about something, about a football issue, he'd always come back with something he does still, he isn't left yet, he always comes out with some very interesting and intelligent thought about something. If he's asked about some change in the offside law or VAR or any issue like that, he'll often come back with something interesting, whereas Ferguson would just kind of ignore the question, quite honestly, or just sort of pay little attention to it, really. Whereas Wenger would always come up with something interesting. So I thought that was, he added to the debate about issues and interest in English football, which I thought was good.
Joining us now is Henry Winter, who, Henry, I love the story that you've told. I had heard it before about how I think it was nine of you on the very first day
that he arrived. You know, arson who was famously was the title in one national newspaper. Nine of you were taken into a room with Wenger. And can you talk a little bit about what happened next?
Yeah, sure. Hi, guys. David Dean was obviously concerned about some of the headlines. I mean, the slight myth around arson who, it was a billboard as much as a headline in the Evening Standard. But clearly there was a lot of scepticism initially amongst the players, obviously. A slightly blinkered media to an extent at that time. It's not like sort of social media or YouTube now, when you can immediately, within 30 seconds, find out sort of details about people. So back in 1996, David Dean was concerned about this, so he got Arsene Wenger into the boardroom at Highbury, and he sat all down, and Wenger came in and he spoke for 45, 50 minutes with a few questions along the way, but basically outlining his philosophy, who he was, his passion for Arsenal, his understanding of it. He almost sounded like the club historian, his knowledge already of the club. I know he'd been invited there a few times before to watch matches before he even became manager. So I think it was to sort of educate and enlighten us in that sort of very Arsenal way of doing it sort of quite sort of subtly over tea and cake.
You know, if you had to isolate the top two or three things that he's contributed, not just to Arsenal but to the English game, how would you do that?
Well, randomly, improved training facilities, improved diet, stretching. I think the Emirates as a stadium, in terms of the quality, not simply of the facilities, but the quality of the staff they have there, that certainly set a new benchmark. And obviously other clubs have, you know, went around Colney, went around the Emirates, and have used Arsenal's sort of ideas and Wenger's innovations for their own and sort of taken it on another step. Absolutely. I mean, the commitment to entertain, I think, was just fantastic. So, yeah, I mean, so many positives. But I mean, I was at the Emirates yesterday, and I was really surprised by the reaction of the fans. I mean, we were just looking around each other, partly sort of walking in. It was quite quiet outside. I was expecting far more of a sort of emotional outpouring. I understand all the sort of the apathy, and I've been writing about it for sort of 7-8 years in terms of the obvious decline under Wenger. But I actually thought the Arsenal fans would say, right, we've got our way. He is leaving. Now back him. It was very, very strange yesterday. And I think a lot of the pieces and the, you know, since then have reflected that. Obviously on the back of the press conference as well, in which he had a fairly measured pop at the fans. It wasn't a rant or anything, whatever you might read in certain headlines. But he obviously wanted, he was hurt and he wanted to get his point out about the fans. But yeah, it was really strange. I mean, if that had been Anfield or, you know, another club which had an emotional engagement with a manager, even if it's, you know, turned sour over recent years, the fact that he is going, I was expecting far more support for him. But, you know, it just reflects the, you know, the depth of the schism that's happened over the last 6-7 years.
I want to try to bring a little bit of clarity as to what exactly happened and your understanding of what happened, Henry. For me, it's fairly simple. At 10 o'clock on Friday morning, there's an announcement from Arsenal with a statement from Wenger saying that he was going to step down at the end of the season. And literally 5 minutes later, an article by Josh Robinson goes up in the Wall Street Journal, which explains that Wenger is resigning now rather than at the end of the season because he wanted to avoid being sacked in the summer. And he was resigning now rather than at the end of the season because he wanted clarity. He didn't want uncertainty to go and affect the team between now and the end of the campaign. That's why I, like many others, came to the conclusion, quite evidently, that, you know, this, we can call it a resignation. Oh, isn't it great he's leaving on his terms? But, you know, it's not quite Sir Alex leaving Manchester United when he did. And that, you know, Wenger is still sad, and he would have wanted to stay another year. But at the same time, it seemed that, you know, when they put the question to Wenger at the weekend, he said, well, I said everything I needed to say in that statement, didn't confirm or deny. Gazidis himself didn't quite confirm or deny. What's your take? Is this kind of like one of those games that maybe for legal reasons, clubs and the media play?
No, I think it's clear he was pushed. I I don't think there can be any doubts about that. I mean, this is a man who's obsessed with Arsenal. You know, he's never broken a contract in his life, so clearly, you know, he was pushed. I don't think there's any doubt about that, whether the pressure came from the boards, media, or less so the media, or the fans as well, the sight of all those empty seats. The fact that, you know, I've got a lot of friends who are supporters there, and a lot of them who are hardcore Arsenal fans were just delaying on club-level renewals. And that was... money talks loudest in football, and I think that was clearly an issue for the club. This emotional and financial issue for them was clear. That press conference actually yesterday was quite sad, and you could just see this wounding. It's interesting, I mean, talking to some of the French reporters who were at Wembley on Saturday and then at Emirates yesterday, and talking about how and why and of what substance Wenger will do a book. And there's a colleague of his he knew from his Strasbourg days who is sort of likely to do it. But it's interesting what some of the French journalists were saying. They said they didn't think it would be a particularly good book because Wenger, I mean, it'd be a fascinating book in terms of there'll be genuine insight, but he won't go round blasting everyone, you know, because there won't be a chapter exploding Yazidis in it, because that's just not Wenger's style. But you could just tell yesterday, this is a very civilized man, and you know, like Stuart being very critical of him, but you know, he's a very genuine, dignified man. So, and the sad thing is I can't see how this being a sort of a gentle, you know, go fondly into the night. This, I think this is going to be quite messy, this departure. And please spare me all the comparisons with Ferguson. The situation is different on so many grounds. Ferguson basically went in and got Van Persie because he effectively knew it was his last season. Got Van Persie from Arsenal, sign of weakness from Wenger that he allowed Van Persie to go. Got the title, and Ferguson went off into the sunset with millions of other things to do because he's a character like that. Ferguson went on a high, out on a high. Now, obviously, there's the potential for Wenger to go out on a slight high with, you know, Europe's B competition. But still, there's really no comparison there. Ferguson was completely in control of his, you know, apart from decision by a referee and sending Nani off at against Real Madrid. Ferguson was in control that season, whereas Wenger ceded control.
You put it like that, I get a little bit, I get a little bit melancholy here, because my instinct is that it didn't need to be this way. Was the fundamental mistake on Arsenal's part also in terms of maybe ensuring a sort of a tidier exit, basically not saying goodbye at the end of last season? And even if you had to be, you know, hard about it, you know, you would have saved yourself the Lacazette money, you would have saved yourself even the whole thing that they gave him a 2-year deal rather than a 1-year deal. Is that where they kind of, you know, from a business perspective, kind of drop the ball?
The, you know, great minds at Harvard Business School will probably be doing pieces on this and lectures on this in years to come, and the power vacuum and how authority, when it's so, you know, centralized in one individual as it has been in Wenger, it is very, very dangerous, particularly when there are threats from other clubs financially and with better coaches coming in and with Wenger clearly being overtaken. There was no succession planning. There was no challenging of Wenger. I mean, you know, you've got Stuart there, you know, Tony Adams to an extent, Patrick Vieira. You know, all these individuals who know and have the club at their heart and who are intelligent individuals and can contribute. They were almost, not ostracized, too strong a word, but Patrick Vieira should have been embedded in the heart of Arsenal for the last sort of 4 or 5 years. But Wenger doesn't like confrontation. He doesn't like people standing up for him. You can look at that in his team. Teams reflect their manager, and there's no real backbone in that team to stand up when things get difficult. And, you know, Yazidis should have realized that earlier. Conkey, of course, he's an absentee owner, should have realized that earlier, should have got more involved. So this culture of no authority, no challenging, was just allowed to fester like Topsy. And it was just, and it's damaged. So everyone's talking about, oh, he should have gone after the last cup final. He should have gone 3 or 4 years ago, because everyone, you know, you could see the decline. Little things like, you know, the one comparison you can make with Ferguson as a contrast is Ferguson always rotated his number twos to challenge him more. You know, Wenger didn't do that enough. There was no one challenging him, and there was this just drift allowed to accelerate. So, look, it's good that the board have now acted in the past year to create this this structure, this more modern structure with the individuals they've brought in to sort of accelerate recruitment and not allow players' contracts to run down. But really, they should have been doing that a long time ago. I think when Gazidis arrived, he came in with, obviously, experience of MLS. He's an, you know, he's an intelligent individual. But just because you've got a blue from playing at Cambridge doesn't mean that you've got the intelligence and the nous to deal with the jungle of English football and contracts and whatever. And the fact that Wenger also helped appoint him, I just think that Gazidis has to bear some culpability for the decline, albeit I think he's responded well over the last year.
Henry, thank you so much for joining us.
My pleasure.
Thank you.
Cheers. Thanks, Henry.
Cheers, guys.
I want to take it back to this point in terms of the what next, because you made a... I don't want to be so negative about Mizenstat and Lehi, but I am interested in this theme, and Mizenstat has a certain background.
Yeah.
Sanlehi has a very different background. They're both football scouts. They have to select a manager who might come from yet another footballing background. You look at, for example, the success at City, where you have a chief executive, director of football, and a manager, all of whom come from exactly the same background. Can that be an issue? I mean, I know, obviously, people have written sort of, you know, management textbooks and sort of Harvard Business School studies about this, but are you better off with different ideas and let's have conflict and people coming from that'll be fruitful and lead us to better outcomes or not? Because when I see this Mizenstat, and the first thing you do is you go and you buy the guy from your old club who wants to leave anyway and has been kind of a pain about leaving, and the only reason he didn't leave in the summer is nobody wanted him at that price. And this is your first sort of genius signing. And then the other guy gets Mkhitaryan because he's a skillful player. And, you know, I think the quote was not from him, but from somebody close to him, was that, well, you know, Mkhitaryan in the open market, you know, you're saving yourself $70 million. I don't know. I don't know where the common ground. I mean, it's an interesting experiment, but generally most clubs don't operate that way.
Because I think there can always be conflict with that, because ultimately, the manager...
If it works, it's a fascinating experiment, and groundbreaking, too.
The head coach is the one that's going to dictate the tactics.
And we don't even have that guy yet.
So the head guy, when he comes in, he's going to dictate the tactics. And if this chief scout is looking at other players and buying players that don't suit the tactics of the manager, you've got a massive problem. So there has to be lots of conversations. There has to be a lot of people getting together saying, well, this is what I look for from, this is the game style that we're going to play, this is the tactics we're going to use, I need this sort of player to be able to do that. And the chief scout might come up with, it still doesn't suit the way I want to play the game. I had it as a head coach when the manager bought a player that didn't suit what I was trying to do, and we parted company. I said, because I'm going to have to change the whole tactics of the team for a signing that you've made. And it can't work.
Bill, looking ahead to this, obviously the next manager is going to be a really important cog in this machine. And typically there's names out there all the time. Already there's talk of Luis Enrique. Thomas Tuchel was linked before as well, although Tuchel had a really poor relationship reportedly with Mizenstat. If you were an Arsenal fan, would you trust these guys to not just come up with a good solution, but come up with a solution that they fully endorse and own, and so that we don't get into a situation like, remember at Liverpool when you had Brendan and the committee, and if it was a good signing, it was Brendan signing, it was a bad signing, it was the committee and all this nonsense?
One manager I think might fit in might be Eddie Howe. He has a similar style of play, so he could at least fit in with the players they've got at the moment. An attacking, fluid sort of play. He's
got a similar style of play to who? To Wenger?
To Arsenal's current.
Do you think so? I think it's actually very different.
Well, I would say that they have to go away from what Wenger's done, because what Wenger's done hasn't been good enough for the last 10 years, and they have to get the balance right. You know, Arsene Wenger has never concentrated on the defensive side of the game. You don't want a coach that's just going to concentrate on the defensive side of the game, but all the great coaches get the balance right between the attacking side of the game and the defensive side of the game. They've got to have more structure. So it's got to be a structured coach, not just a general manager. It's got to be someone who's going to be out on the training field and tell players, this is your role in the team. This is what I expect from you.
Well,
this
Howe
is what we do.
That.
I'm not sure Eddie Howe would do that.
When I sat down to him with him when we wrote the Italian job, he spent a long time explaining why he played 4-4-2 and why you know, he says you could prove mathematically that 4-4-2 offers the best defensive cover. It's the most efficient way to cover the majority of the pitch, you know, allowing, adjusting for the defensive areas. And he also talked about how, you know, football's changed and it was important to have sort of powerful, athletic people, especially in midfield, who could combine, as he put it, quality and quantity. And obviously he mentioned Petit and Vieira. And it was interesting because he moved completely away from that.
What year? Just remind me, what year was that when you spoke to him?
2005, it would have been. Maybe went into tremendous detail, right?
And it was about 2009 where he suddenly went from two up front to one up front.
Yeah.
Suddenly, just like that.
And then last season he went to three at the back.
Then
suddenly
he had to go at three at the back. Yeah, after 20 years. Yeah.
It's interesting those, and also the type of players. Jack Wilshere, somebody with his build, could you see him in the Arsenal of old when you had, as I said, Petit and Vieira, and you know somebody like Ray Parlour, who maybe wasn't the biggest but was obviously very, very tough physically in midfield. I don't know. I find it to be really interesting.
So do you think,
I don't think there's anything wrong with evolving and changing, you know, but I'd love to, for him one day when he's ready, to go and explain the mindset and talk about why he made those changes, how he made them and whatnot.
He went from, because I didn't cover Arsenal, didn't see Arsenal particularly when he had his success. So I only started watching Arsenal in their last season at the Emirates. That's when I was asked to analyse Arsenal and what they did. So I came, when I went to Arsenal, I thought, this bloke, everyone was telling me he's a genius, this is what he can do, look how he's changed English, he's an absolute brilliant coach. And I started to then look at it and think, I'm listening to his press conferences, I'm listening to what he's talking about in the game, and I'm not seeing that he's reading the game properly, I'm seeing things go wrong, I'm seeing teams come up with ideas that he didn't seem to be able to cope with, the same mistakes were happening time and time again. So then I was asking him the question, what had happened before, was that by luck or was that pre-planned? Because he then went, as you said, he went away from all the things that made them a good team into playing, and they were an aggressive side, they lacked discipline at times, they had lots of players sent off, to a team that he then said, we're fouled too much, we're not protected by the referees, we need to play football, we need to be more creative. Why did that change?
Perhaps he thought he'd won three league titles with the aggressive approach, and he thought, right, I want to do something even better.
Perhaps you heard Brian Clough say that you can always win titles better than somebody else.
I think it's worth remembering that, you know, we're talking about, I think in the Premier League era, only Sir Alex has won more titles. And yes, Mourinho's won as many, okay, but only Sir Alex has won more. And those seven FA Cups in 22 years, I think it's absolutely remarkable. He took an English club to a Champions League final, which again is something that, off the top of my head, I think it's something that only Sir Alex, Rafa Benitez, Di Matteo, and I'm not forgetting anybody else, right? Oh, and Avram Grant. Yeah, those last two kind of ruin it for you, don't you? But anyway. And maybe Jurgen Klopp soon. You know, have done, hey, all these things put together. I mean, this is part of his legacy as well.
That's why it's such a great debate, because there are the people that say all that, and then there's other people that are totally against him. Henry said it, and I know exactly the same. I know a lot of Arsenal supporters that have given up. They don't go anymore. So how many managers actually turn people away from supporting their own club?
I will also say this, though, since he's going and this is part of his legacy. Let's not forget the type of club that Arsenal were when he inherited them. George Graham, Thuriot. You had a culture of, I know we've touched upon it, but a culture of drinking, a culture of not taking care of yourself. Taking Arsenal to the level where they were side by side with Manchester United for that decade, that took a lot. And it's not just down to Arsene Wenger. I think David Dean obviously deserves a tremendous amount of credit for what happened in those 10 years. But they could have gone an entirely different direction. If they had appointed Brian Little or somebody in 1996, we could be having an entirely different conversation about Arsenal. He built this club. Not on his own, but he built this club. And I think for that, whatever might have happened in the last 7 or 8 years, he deserves a lot of credit and a lot of respect. All right, enough Wenger. How about some quick hits? Manchester City romped to a comfortable 5-0 win over Swansea, and they get their guard of honour. But Bill, at the end, City fans celebrated with a pitch invasion and reportedly could face a fine, at least according to our reporting today. Are you okay with that? I mean, I appreciate health and safety, and you guys will take this very seriously, but Guardiola says, there's a funny quote, he says, well, I'm not going to tell anybody not to come onto the pitch, which is fine, you're not a steward, but it's a tricky one, isn't it?
Yeah, I mean, I'm all for
pitch invasions.
Celebration.
How many times have you invaded the pitch, Bill? At Old Trafford.
I remember the last day of the 1986-87 season, West Ham Man City. Actually, Man City went down that day. I was on
Wait,
the pitch.
You're, West you're a United fan?
Yeah, but I just went to West Ham a lot.
But so you invaded the pitch at West Ham?
Well, it was just a standard. Everybody went on the pitch on the
last
day. It was
the 80s.
Last day of the
different
season.
Different era.
Like, anyway,
Mick McCarthy, I think, was probably their centre half,
yeah.
Wasn't he?
So I mean, I guess from the FA's point of view, they should say all the players must be allowed to leave the pitch first. Beyond that, it should just be an issue for the club. Do they mind if the grass is being churned up? I don't think it's a big deal.
As long as the grass isn't dry, which brings us up to my next point. Liverpool held to a 2-2 draw by West Brom. I don't think they particularly care because all they're thinking about is the Champions League. But Klopp complained of a dry pitch. Is this a fair complaint?
The pitch was slightly dry, but it hadn't troubled Liverpool for much of the game. I'm not quite sure why he made the complaint. The problem was that they still didn't defend balls into their box particularly well. That's why West Brom and Albion got back into the game.
Is it easier to defend long balls into the box with a wet pitch?
It is, absolutely. Of course it is. No, I don't think there's... Right. He hasn't got any cause for complaint, really. I don't know what he's talking about.
It's 5 points in the last three games for Darren Moore since replacing Alan Pardew. Bill, if you look at the arc of the season in the BP era, before Pards, and the AP era, after Pards, there's only one conclusion you can reach.
Yeah, well, Gary Megson as caretaker had two draws, then Pardew came in, complete disaster, now Darren Moore's come in unbeaten in three. Yes, it doesn't look
and
good
Kubis
for...
And was also getting more points than
he
Pardew
was. Getting
was,
more
yeah.
points, yeah. I mean, looking back, Pulis and also Mark Hughes at Stoke, they had a good track record. It was a huge call to get rid of them early. Obviously, both teams started badly this season, but they've shown they'll overcome difficulties
Pardew,
over and over again.
Pardew for Arsenal, then.
Stop no. it. Arsenal thumped West Ham 4-1 and Alexandre Lacazette bags two goals. Robbo, it was more of a 4-3-3 and they looked more comfortable. Is this a sign of a back-to-basics different Wenger or...
No, not really.
Just
I think,
a bad West Ham?
Yeah, West Ham played actually quite well in the first half and dominated quite a bit of possession, but Arsenal, as they often do at home, when they get on a roll and they score those late goals, 4-3-3 is what Wenger's played for most of his time at Arsenal. He always talked about playing 4-4-2, but Bergkamp played in behind the main centre-forward. He didn't play up front with him. He played in the midfield position. So he always played really with a 4-3-3, but I think when they have the ball, they go where
so
they
what,
like.
So Ray Parlour played as a winger?
On occasions, yes.
On occasions, not on most occasions. Of the time. Crystal Palace and Watford draw 0-0, but Roy Hodgson is furious after Wilfried Zaha gets booked for diving. Do you have sympathy for him? Why does Zaha have more of a negative rep than some other people we could name?
For diving, well...
Like, say, Danny Welbeck!
Yeah, I mean, the first point is everybody...
Is it the English disease, this diving, this trying to cheat?
Yeah, I remember looking at it, the more English players were booked for diving than foreigners, you know, pro rata and all that stuff. But
I hope you don't export it because it doesn't creep into the continental game.
I mean, the point is that pretty much every player dives, either to fall when it's not necessary or to exaggerate the pain. It's just to alert the ref to the foul. It's accepted. I think they should be punished. They should be punished according to the laws, but they're not. So that's what happens. But some players aren't as good at diving as others. They push it too far. So Zaha is one of them. So while he was fouled by Mariappa on Saturday, should have been a penalty, a bit too much of a flamboyant dive afterwards, a bit too much. Rashford also dived badly.
No criticism of Rashford on this podcast. So stop there. Otherwise, Scowcroft will be back.
No, he will. Davinson Sanchez came across and impeded him near the touchline, definitely. Rashford hurdled him and then fell over. But what he should have done, which most players have done, just run into Sanchez's...
Also get hurt.
That's a chance you take. But it's not that Zaha cheats and nobody else does. Everybody else does. He just hasn't got his diving quite right yet.
Mourinho calls it helping the referee to make a decision. The PFA Player of the Year award goes to Mohamed Salah. Good choice. Or Robbo, are you in the Kevin De Bruyne camp?
I would go for Kevin De Bruyne myself if I was voting, because I thought he's been magnificent. He's done things that no other player can do. He's picked passes out that you can't even see when you're watching the game. So I think he's won the title with Man City. I'd have given it to Kevin De Bruyne, but Salah's had a magnificent season as well. Played way beyond the expectations I thought of him.
Simple question. If De Bruyne weren't there, would City have still won the title? And if Salah weren't there, would Liverpool have finished top four? What's more likely? Yeah, you
probably,
need to think about it.
Yeah, I'm having to think about it, which means you're going to say that Salah should be floating.
Of course. De Bruyne is fantastic. Both of them, give it to both of them if you can, but take Salah out of Liverpool, and I think this season, I think they're neck and neck with Chelsea. Take De Bruyne out, and oh, look, there's Gundogan. There's freaking Foden. There's Bernardo Silva. There's some other dude in the middle.
They still wouldn't
have
been
as good.
And they
still win. What?
They still wouldn't have been as good.
No, but they still win the title.
Okay. Gab, one for you. Big top of the table clash in Serie A. Juventus hosting Napoli. I assume Juve squeezed out a late goal and took the 3 points. Is that true?
There was a late goal, but it wasn't Juve who scored it. No, it was tremendous. It was Napoli who, for the whole game, Napoli just kept attacking and attacking and attacking. And Juventus were so negative and so horrendous. And I think Allegri absolutely got it completely wrong. The problem with Napoli is they attack, but Juve are still pretty good defensively. So, you know, Napoli couldn't break through. And in the end, ironically, it was a big towering header from the big man, Kalidou Koulibaly, deep in injury time, that gave Napoli the win.
Does this mean that Napoli are going to win the title?
I'm not going to go out on that limb, but they have a shot because in the run-in, because the gap is now just a single point. At halftime in last week's game, the gap was 9 points. So that's how incredible this turnaround has been. Juve still have some very, very tough games. They're away to Inter next week, which I know it sounds Inter. What have they been tough? But, you know, if Perisic and the Bras decide to show up, they can make life difficult. And they're also away to Roma, who, of course, though by that point, Roma will probably be distracted by having to play the Champions League final against Real Madrid.
So once again, Serie A is the top league in Europe.
I don't know if it's a top league, but it's certainly a very exciting finish.
Hi there, and welcome to The Sweeper, which is the Times' fantasy football tips service. My name's Charlie Scott, and as ever, Paddy Bombear's here with me.
Hello there.
And yeah, I mean, we both paid our free hit this weekend to varying degrees of success. I, for one, am not a fan. The temporary wildcard aspect of it just made me as indecisive as I have ever been.
Yeah, taking Lacazette and Arnautovic out at about 11:20 on Saturday morning was not my finest hour.
Yeah, I did Wayne Hennessy for Nick Pope, so that was good. Hennessy, clean sheet and bonus points for Palace. Then I swapped Monreal, who scored for Arsenal, for Mustafi, who didn't score for Arsenal, and swapped Aubameyang for Welbeck.
Bit of a failure all in all.
Yeah.
Hopefully some of you out there had a good free hit. Lacazette, as mentioned, 13 points for Arsenal was the top of the pile. And those reliable City midfielders, Sterling and the two Silvers, all pitched in with double figures as well. So there were plenty of points to be found.
But just not for anyone who picked Kyle Walker and Leroy Sane.
On the subject of Bernardo Silva, I would say for a very brief brag, it was only a few weeks ago that we mentioned he might be a nice differential heading into the end of the season. Once City have won the title, I'm expecting him to play a few games for them now. And he started off pretty well there. He got his goal after Jesus missed the penalty, and he got 3 bonus points too. And also a little cheeky word for Salomon Rondon. I don't know if you mentioned, it must have been about 5 or 6 weeks back now. We said he might do okay despite West Brom having effectively given up. He's actually scored or assisted in five of their past six games. He's getting about 6 points a game. So that's the beauty of fantasy. Even if the team is bombing, the players can still pitch in and be useful for you.
Absolutely. And West Brom actually look like they're trying since old Pard's left. What have we got in store?
Well, there's a double game week coming up in 37. That is, of course, not this weekend, but the following week. So it might be worth everyone saving their free transfer if possible and looking to stock up, particularly on City and perhaps Spurs players. Their fixtures look incredible. So try and find a player who's going to play both games and there could be big points. And the subject of City, their goalkeeper.
Oh, absolutely. Edison, who I'm a fan of because he can get assists, which is great. But also, he came out after the game against Swansea and sounded a bit disappointed that he wasn't allowed to take the penalty, which Gabriel Jesus missed. He said he wants to score before the end of the season. So City have got nice, easy fixtures in store. Maybe worth getting in. Imagine those points if he kept a clean sheet and scored. I don't even know how many points a keeper gets if they score.
For all the usual stuff, just go to thetimes.co.uk/fantasyfootball, sign up. We'll send you an email every week with some tips. Or you can go to Facebook and join our group. Just search for The Sweeper, post your questions, and we will answer them right away.
That's all we've got time for today. Many, many thanks to my guests, Stuart Robson and Bill Edgar, and of course, the franchise. Joining us down the phone, Henry Winter. Remember, it's just £8 for an 8-week trial. Just search The Times online, and this season you can access highlights of every game in the Premier League, Champions League, Europa League, FA Cup, as well as all our excellent content, as well as the excellent content of the Sunday Times. We'll be back next Monday after weekend when Stoke and West Brom could both be relegated. Till then, bye-bye.
The Game is brought to you by The Times. For more information and more podcasts from The Times, head to thetimes.co.uk.
Rising sea levels, extreme weather patterns, extinctions of species. Our planet needs protecting. I'm Adam Vaughan, the environment editor for The Times, and this is Planet Hope from The Times, in partnership with Rolex and its Perpetual Planet Initiative. In this podcast, we hear from leading experts from around the world who are committed to finding solutions. These explorers, scientists, entrepreneurs, and citizens are committed to a common goal: to protect our home, Earth. Listen now wherever you get your podcasts.
Acast powers the world's best podcasts. Here's a show that we recommend.
Hey folks, it's Mark Maron from WTF. I've been talking to all kinds of famous people in my garage since 2009, including a sitting president.
You know, I don't imagine you were flying in here on the chopper thinking like, you know, I am nervous about Mark.
No, I wasn't.
Okay, well, that's good.
That would be a problem.
It would be a problem.
If the president was feeling stressed about
coming to my garage.
Coming to your garage.
And now there's even more WTF when you subscribe to the full Marin to get weekly bonus content and all WTF episodes ad-free. Listen to WTF wherever you get podcasts and subscribe to the full Marin at go.acast.com/WTF.
Acast helps creators launch, grow, and monetize their podcasts everywhere. Acast.com.